from the Radio Ranch in the heart of Liberty, Texas, that is. It's the Bombastic Blogcast for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. I am the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
Either yourself, defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, and one heck of a nice guy. Let's get things officially started with...
The Daily Datagram.
You got it. Words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets. You get to make the call. Good one here, too. It says, there's an exception to every rule, and most people think they're it. Particularly politicians.
You should be ashamed.
All right, let's move along now with the so-called educational part of the big blogcast.
Twisted history.
This should be good.
Gather around, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
Gotta be sure.
Some cool, some not so cool. Just the same. You need to know your twisted history.
Yes, you do.
You might be quizzed.
See, there you go. Well, kids, it was on this day in 1912, the ill-fated RMS Titanic began sea trials. Funny, everything worked fine during the tests. And it was on this day in 1956, As the World Turns and The Edge of Night premiered on CBS. And the two soaps became the first daytime dramas to debut in the 30-minute format. And millions of American women began to find real meaning to their lives.
I'll never forget this night as long as I live.
Yesterday, a very interesting op-ed came across my desk, and I wanted to pass it along to you. I found it in the Daily Caller, and it's a guest column from a fellow by the name of David Blackman. He's an energy writer and consultant based here in Texas. And he's spent 40 years in the oil and gas business, knows more than a little about it. And he specialized in public policy and communications. So here he is communicating with us, saying that in the wake of the destruction of the Francis Scott Key Bridge at the mouth of Baltimore Harbor, media and public attention suddenly focused on the importance of the nation's ports. Now, no one should doubt the vital nature of the Port of Baltimore to trade on the U.S. East Coast. I mean, the facility is a vital cog in the import and export of cars, coal, and other key commodities. And the legacy media, you know, the mainstream media, has certainly done a pretty good job of telling that specific story as the week progressed, which is to be commended. But one aspect of the story that hasn't been told much, if at all, by these mainstream media outlets is the fact that, as vital as it is to trade on the East Coast, the Port of Baltimore ranks only as the 17th most active U.S. port in terms of total tonnage. And that's according to official data compiled annually by the U.S. Bureau of Transportation Statistics. Now, as you can see, in terms of total tonnage, the nation's real powerhouse is the region along the Gulf Coast, encompassing ports in Texas and Louisiana. See, when you add up the numbers, the top three ports alone, Houston, Corpus Christi, and South Louisiana, accounted for more total tonnage in 2021 than all the non-Gulf Coast ports on the list combined, and did so by more than 200 million tons. So Mr. Blackman says, when I wrote about this at my Substack newsletter, I was challenged by readers over the fact that the vast majority of that tonnage relates to oil and gas activity rather than container traffic. That's true as far as it goes, although the Port of Houston's container tonnage is quite robust. But there's no dispute that most of the tonnage going into and out of both the Port of Houston and the Port of Corpus Christi involves the movement of crude oil or refined products. And most of the activity moving in and out of the Port of South Louisiana, which is actually a complex of multiple closely located ports, involves the staging of oil and gas-related operations in the waters of the Gulf of Mexico. So let's concede that reality. But what is the real relevance? After all, neither the Port of Baltimore nor any other port on Earth would have any ships moving goods in either direction were it not for oil. So, great point there. Oil is by far the most widely traded commodity in the world, and the vast majority of tankers and container ships are fueled by diesel or some other petroleum-derived fuel. Now, without that oil and refined products, and more recently liquefied natural gas, going into and out of all those Gulf ports, the entire global economy would soon grind to a halt. You don't need a PhD to understand that. And this has been the global reality for more than a century now and remains the global reality today. This isn't anything that's about to change, my friend. Even after spending of many trillions of dollars on efforts to subsidize alternative forms of energy up to scale, oil and gas remains indispensable. 25 years ago, oil, coal, and natural gas provided roughly 80% of global primary energy. Up to 80%. In 2023, the percentage had barely changed, and that explains why so much oil and natural gas are imported and exported at Gulf Coast ports, and why so much coal moves through the Port of Baltimore. Now, there are several big lessons for everyone to learn from the destruction of the Key Bridge, and one is just how fragile the nation's transportation infrastructure truly is. Another is how small a percentage of the 2021 $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill's funds were actually targeted to improving and strengthening real infrastructure like roads and bridges. That's the cold, hard reality right there, my friend. But perhaps the most important lesson is the reminder of just how vital a role America's oil and gas industry continues to play in the realm of global trade, despite all the daily demonization it gets from activists, politicians, the environ-Nazis, and the legacy media. That isn't going to change anytime soon. It's a great op-ed, and that's something we need to program into our memory bank. I mean, you've got all these loudmouths on the left who want to put an end to carbon emissions, which really no one has proved are all that harmful. I mean, it's like Rush Limbaugh used to say, Mother Earth knows how to clean her atmosphere. Now, you look at the progress we've made over the last 50 years in cleaning up the air, and this is something I know a little bit about because I live in the Houston area. I remember back in late 60s, early 70s, when you were on the east side of Houston, let's just say you were coming in from a place like Beaumont, driving toward Houston, going west on I-10, and you'd hit the industrialized side of Houston, which is the east side, the area along the Houston Ship Channel, probably one of the world's highest concentrations of chemical plants and refineries. And every afternoon, you would see this yellow-green, brackish-looking cloud that would rise up from the city of Pasadena, Texas. Places like Jacinto City, Pasadena, La Porte, where all these refineries were. And this cloud would just work its way north over I-10. And, boy, the air would smell of sulfur. It was awful. Well, I drive that route pretty frequently these days, living in the lovely little town of Liberty. You go into Houston today, there's no brackish cloud. No cloud at all. The air has been cleaned up. 100%? No, probably not. But I would have to say probably, I'll just pull a figure out of my hat. 85 to 95%. The air is clean. You see the sky. You can see the San Jacinto Monument from I-10. So we've made a lot of progress. You look at the area where I grew up, northern Ohio. When I was a kid growing up on the shores of Lake Erie, you couldn't swim in Lake Erie. There were signs up, no swimming. All the beaches were closed. And Lake Erie today, blue water as it hits the shore. It's beautiful. And yes, all the beaches are open. Now, at what price? Well, there was a price to the economy of Cleveland, to be sure. The heavy-handed EPA closed down a lot of businesses. The steel industry in Pittsburgh got hit particularly hard. But I remember my dad talking about taking business trips to Pittsburgh. And when he would go there, he noticed that the streetlights were on 24 hours a day. So we made a lot of progress. And I think really, if we're going to continue to live in a manner to which we Americans have all become accustomed, if we're going to go back to the lifestyle that we once enjoyed before Joe Biden and company totally destroyed our economy and our standard of living, and our morals. If we're going to go back to that, we have to understand that we humans must continue to live peacefully with the oil industry. It's absolutely necessary. The late comedian Moms Mabley, who was a hoot. Man, she used to be on the Merv Griffin Show all the time. Very funny lady. She started out in the late 1930s as a big band singer and then became a stand-up comic, and she was just a hoot. She used to say, "Sometimes I think the whole darn world just done gone crazy." And it has. Authorities in California threatened a fine against a 102-year-old wheelchair-bound man if he didn't paint over graffiti on his home's vandalized fence. A fellow by the name of Victor Silva, an Oakland resident who's lived in the same home for the past 80 years, painted over the graffiti on the fence behind his home after city authorities implemented a March 19th deadline. Now, Silva very often finds graffiti, sometimes referred to as urban art. Urban art. It's all in the eye of the beholder, you know. And often an indication of urban decline, too, by the way. Painted on his fence, according to a TV station out there that's been following the story, KTVU. And things are getting rather contentious out there. Now, earlier in March, Silva was told by the city of Oakland that he needed to paint over the graffiti by March 19th, or the city was going to levy an $1,100 fine, with another potential $1,277 for each failed re-inspection. Now, Silva's daughter-in-law, Alina, said, "It was so absurd, it's like a joke. If you drive around the city and see the graffiti everywhere, it's just, I don't know what to say." So Silva told the TV station that he was a contractor in his earlier days before being confined to a wheelchair and that it was easy to paint over it himself. Well, he says, just had a roller and a paintbrush and just painted it. And then he noted that he's going to be 103 in 2 months and that he's slowed up a bit. Yeah, I would think so. Now, currently, his 70-year-old son does the painting, but he said it's hard to keep up with it because as soon as we get it painted, it's going to be graffiti on it again, and it won't last. Well, anybody who's ever had to live with graffiti understands that's how that works. So Silva Jr. said that the family owns a commercial property that's been broken into 3 times in the last year, and that each time that he's called 911, he gets put on hold every time. So it's hard to understand where our tax dollars are going, he says. They can't answer 911, but they can come out and hassle you about a fence. I'd hate to think that there are other 100-year-old people that are being harassed like this. Oakland City Inspector is aware of the issue, said he was going to inspect the fence and consider canceling the citation. Well, I would suggest that he do so. And then, this, by the way, was a news story that appeared in Daily Caller. So I scrolled down to the comments section, and this first one, I like the way people are thinking. The commenters are supportive, of course. And this one commenter said, sounds like someone wants his property and the city's the tool to force him out. Fine enough, then. Put on a lien and sell at auction for failing to pay the fines, or he's forced to sell before they levy those fines. Corrupt government officials. Power corrupts. Total power totally corrupts. Well, that's true. And somebody else wrote, if the city government wants graffiti-covered walls cleaned up, they should pay for it or assign convicted criminals to do the work because it's they who allow this destruction to happen. Wonderful point. Common sense. You're looking for good common sense? Go to the public. It's a great source for common sense, and that is an excellent point to be made. Let the criminals clean up the mess. Sometimes I wonder which side of the fence these judges, these federal judges, stand on. You know, when it comes to issues like the border? An El Paso magistrate judge has ordered the release of illegal aliens who were detained in connection with that big border entry point riot that overwhelmed Texas National Guard troops last week. You remember that. The video was stunning. And according to a report from the El Paso Times, the Easter Sunday order was handed down by Magistrate Judge Humberto Acosta during an online teleconference bond hearing. Now, the judge accused the El Paso District Attorney's Office of not being ready to proceed with detention hearings for each defendant. So he ruled, quote, "It is the ruling of the court that all the rioting participation cases will be released on their own recognizance." Now, the arrests were made by the Texas DPS, Department of Safety. It's kind of like our, the DPS is the Highway Patrol, but they also preside over the Texas Rangers. And this was following a March 21st incident where a huge mob of illegal aliens tore down border fencing and assaulted the Texas National Guard personnel as they tried to gain entry into the states. Now, the mob of mostly Venezuelan men, soldier age, overwhelmed National Guard troops. And this was in the Riverside area of El Paso's Lower Valley. And some members of the mob are facing charges of assault of a public servant for knocking down National Guard personnel. Now, the illegal aliens had sought to bypass Texas border security and instead surrender themselves to federal border patrol agents in hopes of having their asylum claims processed. So I understand their point of view. Remember, they were leaving Venezuela. Venezuela these days is like, it's been described as hell on earth. So I can understand these people desperately needing to get into the United States. And I guess if you're desperate enough, you will resort to violence, which is what happened here. Now, the El Paso Times noted that it's unclear at this point whether Judge Acosta's ruling applied only to charges of riot participation rather than more serious charges of assault on law enforcement personnel. So right now, we don't really know how many illegal aliens have been charged with riot participation, though Acosta noted that hundreds of arrestees were entitled to individual detention hearings within 48 hours. Whether that's actually going to take place, I don't know, because they're snowed under down there. They really are. And Assistant District Attorney Ashley Martinez asked for a continuation in order, or what they call a continuance, in order to resume the hearings at a later date. And this request was denied by Judge Acosta. So Acosta said during Sunday's hearing, he says, "So if the DA's office is telling me that they're not ready to go, what we're going to do is we're going to release all these individuals on their own recognizance." And we always know how that turns out, don't we? Now, court officials noted that arrested illegal aliens will remain detained if there is a federal immigration hold blocking their release. And another hearing for additional defendants is currently scheduled for, I guess, today. So we'll see how this works out. But I guess in a manner, I understand the judge's motivation. But again, these people, I don't care about their situation. I know I should. I should be more compassionate. But wasn't I showing compassion a second ago when I mentioned these people are coming from Venezuela, a place described as hell on earth? It is. Venezuela is communist. They are living under a dictatorship down there. So yeah, these people are desperate to get somewhere where they can have a taste of freedom. So in that regard, I do sympathize with these people. But just the same, they're breaking our laws. They are destroying our sovereignty. And I think the judge ruling the way he is only assisting them. We need to talk about this. Just moments after RFK Jr. introduced Silicon Valley lawyer and entrepreneur Nicole Shanahan as his running mate, happened last week, the independent presidential candidate saw backlash from both Democrats and Republicans for the selection. "I didn't see this coming." Well, yeah, I mean, I knew there was going to be a lot of backlash from our side, but from the Democrat side as well. In Oakland, where Shanahan grew up, Mr. Kennedy called the ticket a spoiler for President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. And then he cited polls that indicated more than half of American voters don't want to see a rematch between the two presidents. That's a claim that Kennedy made. He said millions of Americans aren't going to vote at all if they're not given another choice. They're simply withdrawing from democracy. Well, Nicole and I are going to give those millions another choice. Okay. Well, after Ms. Shanahan was announced as Mr. Kennedy's running mate, Trump expressed his view on Truth Social. Let me read that to you. RFK Jr. is the most radical left candidate in the race by far. He's a big fan of the Green New Scam and other economy-killing disasters. I guess this would mean he's going to be taking votes from crooked Joe Biden, which would be a great service to America. His running mate, Nicole Shanahan, is even more liberal than him, if that's possible. Kennedy is a radical left Democrat and always will be. It's great for MAGA, but the communists will make it very hard for him to get on the ballot. Expect him and her to be indicted any day now, probably for environmental fraud. He's crooked Joe Biden's political opponent, not mine. I love that he's running. You know, now, if that's really an accurate analysis, I don't know. But it's nice to see that tone being used by Trump. And the criticism marked a sharp contrast to the early stages of his campaign when Kennedy was opposing President Biden in the Democrat Party primary. Because Trump called Mr. Kennedy a very smart person and noted he's hit a little bit of a nerve. His heart's in the right place and he's doing really well. That was back then. Now, naturally, the rhetoric is going to change because it has to. Anyhow, the former president's sentiments changed when Kennedy announced last October that he was going to run as an independent. Trump and Kennedy have similar views on topics like protecting the border and ending the Russia-Ukraine war. And I like that aspect of this. I really did. The fact that they saw eye to eye on the Ukraine thing. Ukraine is not our war. COVID-19 is a topic where Kennedy and Trump differ the most. Because Kennedy criticized Trump for not asking the questions he should have during the pandemic. And just for the record, I agreed with Kennedy on that count. I really did. Still do. But Trump knew that lockdowns were wrong. And then agreed to lockdowns, according to Kennedy. And I think, by and large, that's true. He also knew that hydroxychloroquine worked. Now, we all know this. We know that Trump knew this. Hydroxychloroquine worked. He even said it. And then Kennedy explained that he was eventually rolled over by Dr. Fauci and his advisors. Now, you want to talk tyranny? There was the real tyranny. Fauci and company. Now, an outspoken critic of Trump's Operation Warp Speed program that escalated the availability of COVID-19 vaccines, Kennedy said on X that Donald Trump clearly hasn't learned from his COVID-era mistakes. I disagree with that. I think he's learned. But I don't think we're ever going to see a day when Donald Trump actually admits that he was wrong. Out of all the many virtues of that man, that's his one big fault. He can't seem to ever admit that he misfired on anything. So Kennedy said last month, he says, Trump fails to recognize how ineffective his warp speed vaccine is as the 9th shot is being recommended to seniors. Even more troubling is the documented harm being caused by the shot to so many innocent children and adults who are suffering myocarditis, pericarditis, and brain inflammation. You know, this stuff has not stopped. It's continuing. We're just not hearing about it as much as we were. You think the mainstream media really wants to report to you about the dangers of these COVID vaccines? Not on your life. So then on March 26th, Kennedy said President Biden and President Trump both worked to close our main street businesses for a year. 3.3 million businesses with no due process, no scientific citation, no public hearings, and no environmental impacts. All true. That was true. Where was Trump when these businesses were trying to reopen? He did get steamrolled. Now, I don't believe that Trump will ever let that happen again. Because say what you will about Donald Trump, the man learns. He is trainable. So those policies transferred $4 trillion from the middle class and created 500 new billionaires in 500 days. Together, they ran up a greater debt than all previous presidents combined since George Washington. Again, that's a statement from RFK Jr. And then he says, if we vote for either of them again, we can expect and we will deserve more of the same. Again, I don't agree with that. But it is part of the political process, rhetoric like that. Now, outside the venue on March 26th, the truck funded by the DNC circled the street, and it was adorned with video boards on both sides, covered with images of Kennedy and President Trump, and messages like, RFK Jr. has the same biggest donor as Donald Trump, and RFK Jr. is funded by MAGA. Timothy Mellon, who's one of President Trump's top donors, has given more than $20 million to Kennedy-aligned Super PAC American Values 2024. According to the FEC, you know, the Federal Election Commission, a Harvard Caps Harris poll conducted on March 20th and 21st showed President Trump with 41% support, followed by Biden at 37% and Kennedy at 15%. So the figures are kind of falling into place where I expected them to. I mean, this election is going to be a lot closer than the Trumpers would have you believe. But I don't think it's going to be as close as the pollsters say it will be. But I could be wrong. Okay, that is not my field of expertise. And I have never pretended that it was. But the study also indicated that Kennedy has a net favorability rating that's 13 points higher than Trump and 24% better than Biden. Now, the DNC paid for billboards in multiple locations featuring a similar position, that Kennedy's presence in the race benefits Trump. And earlier this month, the DNC announced the creation of a team to counter third-party and independent presidential candidates. Hired Liz Smith, who's a veteran Democratic strategist who managed Pete Buttigieg's unsuccessful 2020 presidential campaign. So they hired Smith to spearhead an aggressive communication plan to combat Kennedy. And news about the DNC's campaign followed its March 4th complaint, with the FEC contending that American Values 2024 didn't disclose $10 million in loans. You can't be doing that. But at any rate, the entry of RFK Jr. into the presidential race, I think, is just going to, you know, is it going to help Biden? Of course not. Is it going to help Trump? Who knows? What difference does it make? Kennedy's never going to get enough votes to prevent Trump from retaking the White House. I mean, one thing you must remember. We are living in an angry nation these days. And why is the nation angry? It's the economy, stupid. Now, does Trump have a lock on the White House? No. Because we still have the deep state to deal with. And the deep state is deeper and bigger and far more powerful than any of us are giving it credit for. Let's head on over to the Comedy Corner with Bob Smiley.
I love my dad. That's where I got my sense of humor. My dad and I kind of have the same sense of humor, which is weird because we don't look alike at all. My dad weighs 280 pounds. He's 5'7". Yeah, and he's always been big. I asked my grandmother, I was like, was he ever skinny like me when he was young? And she was like, no. He was born on a Thursday and a Friday. And I'm not making fun of him because he loves being big. He loves it. He's always like, Bob, come stand next to me so we look like the number 10. I'm like, but he is. He's just so clever and funny. I was so fortunate to grow up like that. My trying to think of some examples. Oh, actually, that is a good example. Since I didn't look like him, my second junior year in high school, I went to him. Are you guys judging me? This is a clean comedy play. This is supposed to be a lot of Christians here, you know? Act like a Christian. Judge me silently in your mind. I wasn't good at school, and I'm not going to make excuses. I am a Christian. I really am a Christian. I'm not just saying that so Hollywood will love and embrace me. But I really believe that God has given all of us individual talents, and I think he made me to do comedy, but it also means my brain is a little process weird. Like, you know, first grade, my teacher said, class, you have to raise your hand to go to the bathroom. I was like, no, you don't. Watch. So I didn't date much. It doesn't matter when I went to him, but I went to my dad. That was the whole point of the story. I went to my dad and I was like, I don't look like you at all. Was I adopted? And he goes, yes. But they brought you back. So, who's going, oh, he wasn't a mean dad. He just was very funny. Okay, some things he did was mean. He actually convinced me if the ice cream van was playing music, it meant it was out of ice cream. He taught me how to play slug bug. You see a Volkswagen Beetle, you punch a person. Yeah, he taught me the rules, and he drove me to a Volkswagen dealership. That wasn't even the worst one. The worst prank he ever pulled, it took me 6 months to catch on, was every night he had me take communion. And I thought it was because I was a really strong Christian kid. And finally, my brother was like, dude, he's just giving you NyQuil.
That'll do it. Make it a terrific Tuesday. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on tomorrow's bombastic blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And be sure to take some time today just to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
You mean that's it?
See you tomorrow, G-Man.